Sign says closed.
Yeah, we were looking to buy some gas.
We also wanted to get directions?
Yeah, we're looking for, what's it called?
Tillerman Road.
I've seen plenty come and go. Hell, I've been here since the war.
Which war?
You know damn well which war.
Would that have been with the blue and some in gray?
You sassing me, boy.
You were rude to my friend.
That whore.
What'd you say?
I think we got enough gas.
You got enough to get you there. Getting back. That's your concern.
Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of The Collision. This is our weekly podcast where we talk about movies, TV, and more. I am Collider's managing editor, Matt Goldberg, and with me today are Adam Chitwood.
Hello.
And Dave Trumbore.
Hey, guys.
Okay, we've got a big show for you this week. We've got great news to discuss and a little movie called The Cabin in the Woods, which received a C cinema score, which means it's terrible. Means it's a bad movie that no one will ever appreciate or like, and that it's really not worthy of discussion. But we're going to grit our teeth on a movie actually all three of us loved and a lot of thoughtful people love. And we're going to hold that till the end of the show because we're going to be discussing spoilers. So if you haven't seen Cabin, this is going to be about a 40-minute episode for you. So to recap how the show has gone so far, first week, rough debut show. Then we leave for a week. Then in week two, what happened in week two? We had been off for a week. I forget what happened in week two. I apparently don't pay attention to our own shows, but this week...
technical difficulties?
Let's say that. Let's say technical difficulties. And then, so in week three, we're saying, welcome back. You're only getting 40 minutes of show if you didn't see this movie. Or if you don't care about spoilers, jump on in. Usually we won't really... We'll talk around spoilers, but because the filmmakers have made it very specific that they only want people to know that five people go to a cabin in the woods, bad things happen. That's all they want people to know. We're going to respect their wishes. But we can't talk about that movie without going into spoilers. It just can't happen. So we're holding it till the end. So that being said, we are going to kick off with news, and then we'll do recommendations, and then we'll do Cabin. So we'll let you know when to turn off the podcast. And then when you see Cabin, come back and then listen to what we had to say. All right. So kicking it off, let's just go three for three on the Hunger Games. Let's do this. Actually, we should just call this podcast the Collision / Hunger Games podcast. That's the new name. I'll drop a new image for it. Gary Ross is not going to direct Catching Fire. So what did we – again, I don't remember last week's show. Did we think he was coming back? I don't know. What was the opinion?
We all thought he would eventually come back, I think.
Yeah, well, we're clearly good predictors of the future. We're clairvoyant. So he didn't want to come back because the tight shooting schedule – and so he's moved on. Now has come the inevitable wish list, because Lionsgate is in a crush. It is a tight schedule, and they need someone who is available and who wants to direct Catching Fire and can do it fast. So inevitably, reported as news, Lionsgate has drawn up a wish list. Suzanne Collins, the author, is asking for someone with critical and artistic accolades. So here's the list of names that have come up. I'm just going to read this. David Cronenberg, Alfonso Cuarón, Alejandro González Iñárritu, who did Babel and 21 Grams. And who else do we have in here? So those were three. And apparently, let's just go from there. The wish list is meaningless. It is... I want these people to direct. Well, I want a sandwich. That's not tangible. Of course you want these people, but that doesn't mean they're going to do it. And what's frustrating about these choices is they don't really even give us an indication of what Lionsgate is going for in terms of the sequel. Because, honestly, I know what they're going for. What they're going for is make this like the book. make it fast and make it so it'll make money. Maybe they'd give a little bit of freedom, sort of like Cuarón got with Prisoner of Azkaban. But with this, I personally feel that this is I see more of a journeyman director coming in on such a short schedule. The name, adding David Cronenberg's name to the mix just cracks me up from the get-go. I actually would be interested in Catching Fire if it was David Cronenberg directing. If it was David Cronenberg's Catching Fire and apparently Katniss and PETA have like some phantasmagorical fucking going on and everyone's like, what's this? And it's like, it's better. I'd be down. What do you guys think? Dave, what are your thoughts on sort of the Catching Fire wish list?
Yeah, last week we talked about the possibility. Adam had asked us to just kind of list what directors we think would be good to step in case Ross didn't come back. And I mentioned Cuarón, and I'm pretty sure you guys did too. I would like to see his take on the subject material. I think he could do some interesting things with it because the, without giving too much of the plot away, the things that they get into in the second book are definitely a little more vibrant, a little more, they have that capital kind of feel to it, which is a little, everything's heightened, everything's exaggerated, everything's a little crazier. I think he would have a really nice touch for something like that. Cronenberg, yeah, I don't see that happening. Inarritu, I think, is interesting. Again, you said the wish list doesn't really matter at all. I don't think Inarritu's style fits really at all with this movie. Beautiful is one of my favorite films of the last few years. I don't see the connection with The Hunger Games. So for now, I'm pulling for Cuarón, and we'll see if somebody that was actually on the wish list gets this job or if it's somebody completely out of left field.
Well, here's the thing. I will eat my hat if Alfonso Cuarón signs on.
He's not going to sign on. There's no time for him to sign on.
He hasn't made a movie since Children of Men.
He's in post-production on Gravity. He has no time.
Yeah, he has Gravity coming out in December. He's going to be intricately involved in that post-production. This is just this is Suzanne Collins saying, I would like these people to direct it. The problem is, Suzanne Collins is very, very heavily involved in Catching Fire. She wants it to be like the book. J.K. Rowling was also involved in Harry Potter, but she just said, let me sit down while you read me the screenplay, make it your own. I'll tell you if I have any issues. She had one issue, and Cuarón wanted to add little people in Prisoner of Azkaban, and she said, no, those don't exist in the world. And he was like, oh, fine enough. But, I mean, everything else, she said, make them your own. Their films are supposed to be different. Suzanne Collins does not think this. Therefore, a director like Alfonso Cuarón is not going to sign on if he's not given that creative freedom. The report was saying she wanted approval over director, casting, costumes. No director is going to give that up. So it's going to be a journeyman director, unless something changes and Lionsgate lets them go their way with it.
She can draw up a wish list all she wants. She doesn't own the rights anymore. Lionsgate gets final say. Now she could. Maybe her contract says I have final say over this, but she doesn't. I'm sorry, she doesn't have.
No,
it's not up to her. And you know what? Thank goodness, because it, to me, honestly, when she's demanding that much, it makes me so nervous about Catching Fire as a movie because her book is seriously flawed. Okay, she needs to realize. I don't know. To me, when Ross went out the door, it said here's someone who had established a relationship, who had a vision for this world, and we don't care. What we want is book translated to film. And that is a book that needs to not have a direct translation, but it's probably going to get it. Maybe they'll get someone artistic, in quotes, someone who's not a John Moore or Scott Derrickson, not a journeyman guy, but at the same time, there's a really tight schedule going on. There is now, for an artistic director, there is a huge upside because you have guaranteed yourself a hit. And that's going to give you the freedom to make perhaps another film that had a higher budget than what you would normally get. So there's that in the cards, but I don't know.
And also Catching Fire, I mean, it is flawed and it has troubles, but it has the potential to be a really good movie. It's a very cinematic book. It has some great sequences in it. If you could do some tweaking and change a few things, it could be a really good movie.
It could. And you're right. Dave, you're saying visually there's a lot going on, but we hit these wish list stories all the time. And God almighty, I get flashbacks to the hunt for Captain America. And like, there were like 22 people. It could have just been a reality show, for God's sakes. It's like, who is the next Captain America? And John Krasinski is the Dark Horse. How the hell did his name get in there? I have no idea. No idea how that got in there. But we see it for superheroes and usually or Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. It's this huge sweepstakes for some major job, but it has... It's almost just word soup. I mean, we see it with the Thin Man. You know, here's every popular female actress. Go.
It's just getting to the point where the sausage making is getting reported as news. Like, this happens on every movie. They go through their list of actors. Who do they want to cast? But now it seems like every step of the casting process is being reported, and so we're watching them whittle down. Right. And watching actresses turn down Pride and Prejudice and Zombies left and right.
Gosh, that movie. That just gives me hope for everything, you know? It's like, here's another director to come on through. Can you do anything with this? I don't really want to. Okay. That movie's just I don't know. I think it'll just languish in development hell forever. And maybe Seth Graham Smith will get enough cash. He's like, I'll direct it myself. I'm friends with
Tim. Him and... David Katzenberg were in the running. They really want to direct it.
It's like, I'm pals with Tim Burton. Let me do it. I'm like, okay. No famous people want to be in your movie. Not at the budget I assume you'd have to work with. But yeah. Who knows? Maybe if Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter is a gigantic hit, he'll get to do more? I don't know. Because none of his books have been adapted yet.
Yeah. And that's what he was saying. Steve interviewed him recently, and he said that the script for Pride and Prejudice and Zombies was solid, and he was hoping that the success of Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter would help move that forward quickly. But I don't know what's going on.
Wait, the author and presumably screenwriter of Prejudice and Zombies thinks the script is solid?
That is
good. I'm glad he has confidence. What the hell? What is he going to say? I don't think this is a very good script. I'm not much of a writer, but fingers crossed.
Well, it came about more of, I mean, like, why is this movie languishing for 2 years? Well, no one signed on. It has to be script issues. So he was defending the script. He said it's waiting for the right marriage of director and lead actress.
Okay, then.
We'll see.
We'll see. Okay. Dave, do you have anything else to add on sort of the wish list phenomenon?
I was going to say wish list of Pride, Prejudice, and Zombies. I wonder what Mila Jovovich and Anderson are going to be doing, because I feel like there's your director and your star right there.
What they're doing is Resident Evil.
And... Resident Evil 28.
You know what would be funny, though? Actually, that movie that you just – that combo, you'd have – basically just, I guess, maybe Three Musketeers meets Resident Evil.
Yeah, that's exactly. Almost... It's the movie's already made. You can probably cut it together right now. If any fans are out there listening that like to just randomly cobble together trailers, there's a good one for you.
Hollywood, listen to Dave Trumbore, because he just nailed it. He nailed that movie.
Nailed it. I want a producer credit on this.
He should. He should. An executive producer credit. The one
absolutely.
No, absolutely. That never occurred to me. That is spot on.
Solid. That listen up, Seth Graham Smith.
Yeah. Sorry, Seth Graham. You gotta yield to the director of Resident Evil 1, 3, 4. Did he direct 2? Did he direct 3? Doesn't matter.
No, it doesn't matter.
from the director of movies that aren't any good. All right, moving on. Let's talk about another phenomenon in news reporting, because we're going to show you how the sausage is made on our side. Teasers for trailers. Oh my God, I hate that this happens now, and we're so complicit in it, but so are fans. You may have noticed, if you're a regular reader of the site, that trailers now have trailers. And this isn't new. I mean, we've been seeing this for a little while, but it seems to have just exploded lately. We saw a little teaser for the trailer for Breaking Dawn Part 2, and we saw a little teaser for the trailer for Total Recall. And Prometheus, we got three in 3 days, in 2 days, in 1 day. And now Looper did it, too. It's in 3 days, in 2 days, in 1 day. And... look, I am so excited for Looper. I am so happy to get any look at it that I can. However, you're just giving me the same look three times with brief moments of commentary. The trailer does everything that needs to be done. Those three little things didn't add anything, for God's sakes. It's just, here's a reminder that a trailer's coming. And Looper needs it more than Prometheus or certainly Breaking Dawn, because Looper needs a lot of attention, and I understand that. And I'm almost willing to make an exception, but this is going to continue, guys, and that is nightmarish. Adam, your thoughts?
It's a very bad thing, but I do not see it stopping. It seems like it started with Twilight Breaking Dawn Part 2, which makes sense because those fans, I mean, Twilight fans want to get every piece of footage they can, and I mean, that is tailor-made for those fans, but I guess some other studio saw it and said, well, let's try that with something else.
Well, Prometheus came before.
Prometheus
did do it before that, and I'm sure there were others. But you're right. Like, Breaking Dawn, something definitely, you're right, that seemed to be a turning point.
Yeah, and then, I mean, I guess the fact is, I saw a quote from some studio executive the other day, said one of the teasers for some trailer, I think it was Total Recall or something, was watched umpteen million times online, so it's obviously people are watching them, so why would they stop? It's building awareness for their movies. So I guess, I mean, it's kind of the point of no return now. I don't know how this stops. I don't know, when will people stop watching?
The problem is, where does it stop? Teasers for the teasers for the teasers for the teasers. Here's 1 second, for the 5 seconds, for the 10 seconds, for the 20 seconds.
Watch the first second of Avengers 2.
People that, and it would get millions and millions and millions of views.
Oh, absolutely.
So Dave, let me switch a question over to you.
Yeah.
Where do fans have to take responsibility? Because I feel like we're drug dealers in this equation. I've been watching The Wire, so I just feel like a drug dealer in general. And we feel like the dealers, but someone has to want the product. So don't fans have to sort of shoulder some of the blame here?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that goes without saying. You can turn off, you cannot click on a certain link. I mean, we have to cover a lot of this stuff, obviously, to bring it to the site. But there are some things that I won't click on. I try to stay away from a lot of the Avengers extra clips and things like that. If I have to post something, then yeah, I have to watch it so I know what I'm talking about. But otherwise, I try to stay kind of in the dark for things like Cabin in the Woods, which we can get into in a little bit. But there's a difference in marketing there with they want to get away with showing you as little as possible, which I think is a bit of a shortcoming. They could have got away with a little bit more. And then there's other things like even Looper. You said it needs exposure. I don't know how they're going to have the ability to sustain that level of marketing from now until September if they're going to start putting out little bits and trailers and clips and try to keep that level of interest up.
Oh, they can sustain it, absolutely. I
don't know. It's one of those things where you get drowned out by everything that happens in the summer, and then you try to come back at the end of it and be like, oh, by the way, we're still here. I understand that they need to get the word out so people know what it is. I just don't know if they can sustain it.
I think that actually, I think Film District has a very good plan for Looper, because I think Looper is perfectly placed. It can't compete in the summer. It's not big enough to do that.
Right.
And I was actually surprised that they gave it this much of a lead time. I mean, you're right. That is so big, but they're not going to let it be forgotten.
Sure.
I would be shocked. If Film District comes back to Comic-Con, Looper's going to be part of their presentation. I don't know how they wouldn't make it.
Oh, no, they've got to be. I mean, their only real competition, as far as I know, in September is once again coming back to Resident Evil, because I think they're opening in the same week, two-week time frame, somewhere in there.
Yeah, and it's going to lose to Resident Evil. But well, if it's opening the same weekend, but I mean, that doesn't mean it's going to do poorly. And furthermore, it's really well placed, because when Joseph Gordon-Levitt is doing press rounds for The Dark Knight Rises,
sure,
and Premium Rush, people are going to ask him, hey, what do you got next? They're going to ask him about his upcoming movie.
Oh, yeah, and he's going to push that hardcore, absolutely.
Which is fantastic, because,
yeah,
I mean, I would not want to put Looper before those. I think it is, again, I think Film District has scoped out a great time for it. I like what they're doing. I just don't like that they are perpetuating this trend. I have to hold it for all the movies, you know, don't you? Like,
yeah,
you can't just make
exceptions. Less is more for me. That's kind of the take I've always appreciated. I really like the original. This is going back to like even Cloverfield, something like that, where you do this. That was one of the first teasers I really remember, just being a teaser where they put an image up on screen and you're just like, well, what the hell was that? And then it's a year before you hear about it again. Something like that to me sticks in my mind a little bit more than here's a 2 second clip, here's a 30 second clip, here's this scene behind the scenes kind of thing. The only other thing that I thought recently might have actually worked fairly well was the Host teaser, only because I think a lot of people are familiar with the Twilight stuff, but they might not know Stephanie Meyer's other novel that they're adapting, The Host. I thought that was the only thing that was like, okay, it's you show the main star, you do something that's a little interesting, at least to get people wondering what this movie's about. That I was okay with. All this other stuff where you keep throwing bits and pieces of the movie, I feel like I've already seen the whole thing.
Exactly, and especially as we get closer to release date. I mean,
right.
Throw enough images, trailers, and things together, and it's like, studios are like, don't pirate our movies. I'm like, I don't have to. I can just piece shit together.
I feel like someone could cobble together the Avengers right now with the amount of clips and trailers and images that are there. I feel like someone could do at least two-thirds of that movie.
Right, and how do you... that? And I think that's, again, the question. So how much do people want to know? Studios are all about cracking down on piracy, and people get so spoiler phobic, and I get both of those things. I absolutely agree with both of those things. Not always how they're done, but I agree with the sentiment. But at the same time, it's the marketing machine just eventually becomes this steamroller. And it makes you wonder why bother keeping anything secret in the first place? Do either of you have an answer? Why the secrecy from the get-go? Because we're going to get it all before the film opens.
I like that sense of secrecy, though. I like the directors and the marketing team, if you can get them to do it, that kind of hold things close to the vest a little bit more. I like to know – I mean, everybody knows what Avengers is about for the most part. And obviously, it's a huge movie, and people want to know more and more and more. But if you want to drive them into an even greater frenzy, hold back a lot of that stuff until – I mean, they're not too bad because they're only, what, a couple weeks out from release. So right now, I don't think it's that big of a deal. But for something like Looper, if they keep ramping up the amount of material that's released, I still think they're going to have a hard time sustaining that until September. If they're just out to release a little bit now and get some awareness and then go into hibernation for a little bit and then come back out at the end of the summer, that would be okay.
Okay.
Well, the thing that sticks out in my mind, and this is going way back, I remember in the trailers for M. Night Shyamalan's The Village – were very, very short, they were succinct, and they were really scary. And I remember reading interviews with Shyamalan, and he said, you know, like, people are scared. He was like, they have no idea what's coming. They have no idea. I mean, for better or worse, we had no idea what to expect. But that's a way of literally teasing what it's about. Like, you were intrigued by it enough. And I think if they can get that art form of cutting a trailer back together instead of just throwing, like, explosions, actors, big pretty people like this, you will want to see this movie. If they can get back to just do an artful, like, create a trailer as an art form, like how can I entice people to see this movie without giving the whole thing away, with just giving them just enough that they want to come back for more.
Sure, but I mean that's just it. There's a directive there. There's no trailer artist saying, don't mess with my work.
Yeah, it's
a skill, but I mean, it's absolutely a skill to cut together a good trailer, but they have their demographic, their instructions. They have their saying, we need to appeal to this demographic. To do that, we need to do X, Y, and Z.
Exactly.
And if you don't do X, Y, and Z, then, you know, we focus grouped and market researched, and this is what you must create. And apparently what that research always shows is, as we get closer to the release date, put all your cards on the table. Inception, from its very beginning, when it was first announced and when we were first reporting on it, and it was casting, it's like, it's about the architecture of the mind. And everyone's like, what the fuck does that mean? That's a fucking meaningless, what the hell? But it was intriguing, and he kept the secrecy going right up until the end, and then Warner Brothers is like, here's everything. They're, you know, it's a heist inside the mind, and they're gonna steal it, but he's lost in the, like, they gave you everything deep into the third act almost. And I'm thinking, like, why did you even bother? I don't understand. If you, why can't we just keep that intrigue going just from the get? I mean, people are gonna go see Inception. You've got them hooked. You've got the cast. You have the trailers. You didn't need to go that far with it.
It'll be really interesting to see how the Dark Knight Rises marketing campaign. I know the second leg is about to gear up.
Right.
It'll be really interesting to see how deep they go, because that movie sells itself.
Absolutely.
It really does.
You don't have to do anything.
And yeah, they'll do everything.
Yeah.
I mean, really, they could just put up a bat logo, the title, and the date, and they're like, our work here is done.
Yeah.
Thank you, money. Like, it, I mean, it's just as if the money had agency. All right. We are having a good conversation, but we got to switch gears because we have a lot of cabin to talk about. But first, so far, when we've been reviewing films, we've all been on the same page, a lot of kumbaya. Today, there's going to be some argument because I enjoyed Lockout and Dave did not. Dave, you kick. My review is on the site. I liked it. I thought Pierce was fantastic. I thought it was pulpy, B movie fun. Dave, what were your thoughts on it?
Yeah, so just let me start off by saying I like Luc Besson. I like Guy Pierce. I really enjoyed the cast in this. I really enjoyed the premise of it because it was a very like Luc Besson kind of idea. Unfortunately, I think his involvement with the picture was stressed a little more than was actually necessary. I'm not real familiar with the directors.
It's Europa Corp and anything. Like he's just a producer on anything Europa Corp has. So
sure.
His involvement is nominal.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it's basically, here's an idea. Now you guys can go do whatever you want with it.
Right.
So that kind of sucked me in. The performances were good. I really like Pierce's performance. I did not mind the chemistry between Grace and Pierce. I've read some people that thought Grace was kind of phoning it in, or she seemed like she didn't really want to be there. I thought she did fine, and I actually liked the chemistry between the two of them. It wasn't a very like stereotypical guy saves the girl kind of thing, and then they make out at the end of the picture and go off into the sunset, even though they might have gone off into the sunset. But yeah, I love the performances. But Jesus Christ, some of the dialogue in there was making me cringe, like literally just twitch in my seat. I mean, a lot of it was just, it took me out of the picture. And the pace of it was so rushed and so frenetic, and not in a good way that was like an adrenaline rush, but in like I've only got an hour to put this all together. Let me just cram everything in here. I didn't read your review of it, so I'd kind of like to hear what your thoughts were on it.
My thoughts on it are, it is very slapdash in the way it's constructed, but it's also very single-minded. Its goal is, let's get to that space station and let's let Guy Pierce do his thing. But it takes some shortcuts to get there in a very obvious way. Like, to have Maggie Grace, who's on this fact-finding mission, and for people who don't know, here's the log line. The president's daughter is on a space station. It's on a space prison. It's on a space prison. And there's a breakout. And they send up this former CIA agent who reluctantly goes up there because otherwise he's going to get sentenced to be in the space prison. So this is sort of a deal he doesn't really want, but he has to do it. And there's another reason he's going up there. But basically, president's daughter, from the get-go, when I say president's daughter, you're already like kind of rolling your eyes. And then I say space prison, and then we're off to the races. So it's a very pulpy B-movie premise, but it's,
oh, sure,
let's get him there. And then just, there's, you know, it's a prison riot on a space station.
Yeah, but you know, I picture them like sitting there in the editing room or going over dailies or whatever, and they're like, you know what we need here? We need a high-speed car chase through the middle of the city with really shitty CG and explosions and stuff blowing up. And it's just like that was one of the first times that I was pulled out of the movie. Because I was where the hell did this even come from?
It's a terrible thing, but in fact, I think that kind of encapsulates what I like and not what I dislike, but it's that very, again, slapdash sort of storytelling that's very action-driven, but when you have Pierce at the center, because that scene where it starts off with him wisecracking, and that does a great job of establishing his character.
Sure.
And I definitely think they could have reworked that chase scene, because it looks terrible, and you need to rethink it, because you know you don't have that in your special effects budget.
Yeah,
and
that was just cobbled together last second kind of thing. That was terrible.
Exactly. But
I mean, that kind of thing carried throughout the film. I think it kind of tainted it. Now, I mean, I'm not looking for like a highbrow, you know, the film when I go to see something like Lockout, but I do compare it to Fifth Element, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. I could watch that movie, you know, back to back.
Really? I mean, I like it too, but
God, I love that movie.
I like it too, but Chris Tucker, man, he is definitely something to power through in that movie.
He's
hilarious. Oh my God.
He really is a little too much for me in that movie. But no, Fifth Element's great. I understand totally the comparison. And I think they both carry that sort of pulpy B movie. They kind of have similar protagonists.
Sure.
But again, and I'm not defending Lockout as some masterful craft storytelling. Because back what I was saying is they have Maggie Grace interview this inmate because they're like going to prove to her like cryostasis doesn't hurt their brains. And they bring her out someone whose brain was clearly damaged and psychotic before he even went into the stasis. And I'm like, that's going to be your proof? That's going to be the guy you trot out to convince her that everything is okay on the space prison? And he frees it. He pulls it and gets everyone out and blah, blah, blah. That's, you just sort of, to me, that's, I accept it because I understand what they're going for, and they understand what they're going for, which is we want a light, fast-paced action film with a really strong performance at the center. To me, the film, it's all about Pierce's character, and not as some grand story arc, but it's we want to do everything that we can to highlight this person, and so the story is almost secondary to him, and sure, because he is so, his performance is so good, then it works. Now, I definitely think it could be improved by helping the supporting material, but I wouldn't even go so far to say that he saved the movie as much as the movie is built around him.
It definitely is. The performances, I mean, his was fantastic. Grace was fine. Vincent Regan and Joseph Gilgan, who play the brother content. Inmates.
Yeah.
Those guys were awesome. I thought they did a great job. A lot of the supporting cast was like, you know, good, solid performances. I mean, they were, you know, taking it seriously. But the details, detail-oriented things. You can have a B movie. Well, let me rephrase that. You can have a movie of this caliber and clean up the details. Yeah, but I mean, for a lot of people, a B movie is just kind of like, you know, a boom mic is lowered into the shot and, you know, you have all those kind of...
people don't know what a B movie is, but anyway, go on.
It's quirky things. But the details were what really pulled me out of the story, just the attention to detail. I don't know how many times, I think it was Lenny James's character Shaw, who was sort of the CIA go-between for Pierce, was like, can you hear me, Snow? And I was like, if he says that one more fucking time, I'm going to walk out of this theater. Because he says it, you know, over the headset, he says it at least 50 times, and it was driving me crazy. Other details, like there's one scene, not to ruin it for anybody, but there's one scene where the president's daughter is with her bodyguard in a room. Something happens that all the oxygen is out of the room. So basically, he's like, oh, I'm just going to shoot myself in the head so that you have more oxygen.
Yeah, definitely we should have put bigger spoiler tags on that. I'm sorry.
I've seen that in the trailers. I've seen that.
Oh, it's in the trailers? Okay, then
it's fair game. Stuff like that, too. It's like, it's just bizarre. They just throw these weird moments in there to, like, you know, keep the plot chugging along and, you know, have these little moments, and it just did not work for me.
Okay. I totally get that. I think that's what sort of irked you, I didn't really even notice, because for me it's like I want Pierce to say more things. I just want him to do more stuff, and from that point, like, the film has me hooked, so I enjoyed it.
Fair enough.
Let's move on to recommendations, because we got to get to some cabin talking, but first let's do recommendations. Adam, you've been silent for listening to us jaw about Lockout. For
those wondering, I have not seen Lockout.
Yeah, he didn't see it because, like, apparently there's all these tornadoes in the Midwest, and so he's just making excuses. Adam's just
trying to survive.
He's just being a lazy whiner. That's what I'm saying. Adam, I expect better of you in the future. Tornadoes, shmornadoes, death and destruction. Let's belittle that. Anyway, holy shit. Anyway, you give us your recommendation.
Okay, in fever of the cabin in the woods, I'm going with another fairly meta horror movie or horror comedy. It's 2007's Trick or Treat, directed by Michael Dougherty. He also wrote it. And it's kind of like a horror anthology. If you haven't seen it, I think it went straight to DVD, but a lot of people have found it.
It breezed by theaters, but
did
you're
it
right.
By theaters? Okay. I caught it on DVD. Couple Halloweens ago. It looked pretty cool and watched it, and I loved it. It's really funny. The cast includes Dylan Baker, Brian Cox, Anna Paquin. Basically centers on at least three stories that happen on Halloween night in one town. They kind of intersect a little bit. One of the stories, Dylan Baker is a principal of a school, and that's about as far as I can get before getting into spoilers. Another one involves a group of kids who are going to investigate a mysterious area where a legendary school bus massacre occurred years ago in Days of Lore. Anna Paquin plays a young virgin looking for a date to bring to a surprise party. She's going with a few girls, and it kind of plays on the tropes of horror movies as well, like as Cabin in the Woods does, not as meta or as kind of satirical as Cabin in the Woods. It's a lot of fun, kind of scary, not really. There's a few scary moments, kind of really creepy moments. There's one little creature that kind of connects all the three stories together, but it's a lot of fun. I highly recommend getting it for Halloween if you don't plan on seeing it anytime before then. It's a great movie to sit around with a bunch of friends and watch. Really, it's funny, kind of scary, not too light that it gets a little, it doesn't get fluffy or anything like that. I mean, there's enough blood in it to satisfy the horror fans, but highly recommended.
Okay, right on. Dave, what about you?
Yeah, sticking with the sort of meta horror theme, I'm going to go with 2010's Tucker and Dale versus Evil. It's directed by Eli Craig, and it stars Tyler Labine and Alan Tudyk, I think is how you pronounce his name.
Tudyk.
Tudyk?
Yes.
He's from Serenity, Firefly. I think he's actually an Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter coming up next month. But the premise of the story is basically Tyler and Alan play these two sort of mountain guys, kind of rednecks, going out to their cabin in the woods, so to speak, for just a little vacation. And they happen across this group of preppy college kids that are also out for vacation. But what they do is they turn the horror trope on its head. And rather than being the creepy sort of incest redneck guys that are out to kidnap the college girls, they're just a couple of guys that happen to be misunderstood. And I'm not going to spoil it because a lot of things kind of happen in ironic little twists of fate to these two guys. But basically what happens is the guys, the college guys, end up losing one of their friends. They think that these two rednecks kidnapped her, and they go after them and try to basically the college guys think they're in a horror movie, whereas these two redneck guys are just kind of out for a fishing trip. And it's completely hilarious. It's got a decent amount of gore and some scares for the horror fans out there. And it's a fairly short film. It's about 90 minutes. So it's great for just an evening watch. It's got a perfect blend of comedy, horror, suspense, the scares. It's got everything you want. So I definitely say check out Tucker and Dale versus Evil.
I wholeheartedly agree with Tucker and Dale versus Evil. I saw that
awesome
film.
Movie.
It's so funny. Oh my God. I had so much fun with it. I am going to break with the meta horror theme of my co-podcasters, and I am going to recommend Kingpin because we've had some Woody Harrelson news this week. He's joined Out of the Furnace, and he's also doing a film called True Detective with Matthew McConaughey. And I'm sorry?
It's a TV show.
Oh, it's a TV show. Well,
it's
then.
Season. It's 8 episodes directed by Cary Fukunaga.
Oh, well, then. That negates my point about where Woody Harrelson is. No, thank you. Thank you for clearing that up. I actually thought it was
Oh, it sounds
a
great.
Movie. No, it sounds great. But also, the Farrelly Brothers had a new movie with the Three Stooges, and I definitely think Kingpin is one of their better ones. I think Kingpin almost gets kind of lost between Dumb and Dumber and There's Something About Mary, but I think it is a really funny film and just hits that great blend of dark comedy and gross-out humor and I still crack up when they're like, go milk the cow. He's like, I milked your cow for you. It's like, we don't have a cow. We have a bull. when you're breaking out the bull semen jokes, you've got something special. And there's his life in the Amish country. And then Randy Quaid back when he wasn't completely nuts and just off the grid. And he's good. And if you haven't seen Kingpin, Woody Harrelson plays in my head, I'm like, who hasn't seen Kingpin? And I should probably talk about the plot. Like, who hasn't? Some people. Kingpin, Woody Harrelson plays this great bowler from the 70s, and he was on top of the world. And then he teamed up with this sort of shady figure played by Bill Murray, who is also fantastic. And they try to hustle some guys. They get caught. Murray splits, so they don't get him. They do get Harrelson. They put his hand into a ball returner, which cuts it off. And then, so 20 years later, he's just a complete mess. He has a rubber hand. He's just sour with the whole world. He has to sleep with his ugly landlady if he just wants to, because he can't make rent. And then he comes across this sweet Amish kid who's really, he thinks is really good at bowling when he hears this guy's score. And he wants to basically help him win this tournament in Vegas so they can both get a lot of money. And the kid, played by Randy Quaid, is Amish, so he has to go live in Amish country for a while. There's some jokes at the expense of the Amish, but I'm sure they're good-natured about it. Why wouldn't they be? That was really just prejudiced of me to say, but going off the top of my head, holy shit. Anyway, but they go on the... It's basically what the Farrelly brothers do in most of their movies, or a majority of them. It's a road film. Dumb and Dumber is a road film. There's Something About Mary, a road film, has road elements. Kingpin, road movie. Me, Myself, and Irene, road movie. So it fits into that, into the framework that the brothers are very comfortable with. But it's really funny, and I highly recommend checking it out if you haven't seen it. It's definitely one of the better Farrelly Brothers movies. Three Stooges, just to quickly hop onto that, not as terrible as the trailers make it look.
That is a ringing endorsement.
That is the faintest praise I can give, but...
See, we're going to differ again there, too. I thought it was actually pretty good. It was a lot better than I thought it was going to be.
I agree. No, I thought it was better than I thought it would be. I didn't love it. I think it had some problems. But
sure.
For guys who I have really thought their previous movies have been awful, I thought Hall Pass was terrible. I thought Heartbreak Kid was terrible. Three Stooges is an improvement. And yeah, so, but I would recommend Kingpin. If you haven't seen Kingpin, definitely check it out. Those are our recommendations. We are definitely running long on this show, but it's worth it because we're about to talk Cabin in the Woods. If you haven't seen Cabin in the Woods, the show is over and we've given you 53 minutes of gold. So I hope you don't feel ripped off by what we've been doing. And I really hope that you see Cabin in the Woods. See it, because you want to be on the front lines of this movie. You want to be able to say, I saw that when it was in theaters, because it is so good. And we are going to talk about it, and we have to get into spoilers. I recommend you stay away from spoilers for this film. So thank you for listening. We will be back in a week. Adam and I will. Dave will be on an airplane, and so he will not be with us on the next episode, but we're going to be back. We're going to have good stuff. Thank you for listening, and please come back when you've seen Cabin in the Woods. And as always, please leave us your feedback, because we're developing the show and we want your input. Okay, now, Cabin in the Woods. My review is on the site. Adam, what did you think of the film?
I loved it, and this is coming from someone who's been sitting here reading all the hype on the tweets and the internets before I got a chance to see it. But I finally caught it this weekend, and I thought it was a brilliant deconstruction of the horror genre while also just kind of saying, you know, come up with some new shit, please. Joss Whedon and Drew Goddard expertly kind of put it on. I think the performances were fine. I loved Bradley Whitford and Richard Jenkins. They steal the movie in their two roles. I guess we can get into spoilers here. It's kind of the masters.
Yeah, let's talk about. Let's set up the plot. I'll just run through it real quick. The notes on it are of these five college kids, and they're going to stay at a cabin in the woods because it's the cousin of one of the college kids. We're going up for the weekend, but they're actually pawns in a game where you have these guys, what I call evil mission control. So Whitford and Jenkins, they work at evil mission control. And their whole purpose is they're part of this worldwide consortium to basically people have to be sacrificed to appease basically these Lovecraftian ancient ones who will destroy the earth unless this sacrifice is made. But the sacrifice has to be made in a particular order and fashion. And so they're guided into the cabin, but the cabin is almost like this Truman Show kind of thing where each element can be controlled. They have control of everything, and the kids are kept in there by a force field, so it's expertly controlled. The kids still have some choice in it, but the game is rigged. And basically it goes from there. And now that I've set up the premise of the plot, Adam, sorry I cut you off, continue with what you were saying.
I think it was kind of a brilliant setup going in. I had seen the trailers, I had seen quite a few TV spots. I tried to stay away from them, but I watched The Daily Show every night, and they run quite a few of them on Comedy Central. So I was afraid that I had been spoiled. I had heard from everyone, go in clean, go in clean, go in clean. I knew that Bradley Whitford and Richard Jenkins were in there. Somehow they were controlling what was happening in the cabin. And that was about as much as I knew about the movie going in, and I knew it was going to be different. saying that I still found plenty of twists and turns to love. There was one point where I kind of got a little disappointed in the movie. I got a little discouraged when it's kind of revealed what Bradley Whitford and Richard Jenkins are doing, and then it goes to the part where the board comes up and they find out that they've chosen the Buckners,
the redneck zombie hillbillies.
Redneck zombie hillbillies.
Yeah, whatever it was.
Those chosen, and then I was a little bit discouraged because it was like, oh, so now we have to watch the horror movie with the redneck zombie people terrorizing them. I mean, that's going to be a little boring, but I was proven completely wrong as it took many more twists and turns after that. I was spoiled by one part I would like to talk about. The trailers included quite heavily the stoner dude. I forgot his name. I think
Marty.
Fran Kranz.
Played by Dollhouse's Fran Kranz, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It shows him in an elevator with the lead girl,
Dana.
The virgin, if you will.
Yeah.
And he says, you know, should we go down? That part has been in like every single trailer that's led up to it. So I'm assuming if you're listening, you've seen the movie. It appears that he dies, and I was thinking to myself, well, they haven't gone down the elevator yet, so he doesn't die, or was I mistaken? And so you kind of think the movie's kind of over, where the Bradley Whitford and Richard Jenkins, everyone's kind of celebrating, comes out that, you know, the virgin doesn't have to die, but if she does die, she has to die last. So they've won, the game is over, and then they get an ominous call from a red phone. But all that time, I kind of knew what was happening, which kind of spoiled a little bit, but you know, then it came on with the big reveal at the end with, again, I'm assuming you've seen the movie, Sigourney Weaver makes a cameo. I had no idea she was in the movie. That was a welcome surprise. And I was afraid it was kind of, I mean, the ending of these movies, I mean, it was a great setup and a great movie, but I was kind of wondering how are they going to end this? And I thought they ended it perfectly with even as the world was about to end, even the two left surviving saying, you know, wouldn't it have been cool to see those gods, which is exactly what everyone in the audience is thinking at the time. And then this giant hand coming out of the ground and the credits.
Did we lose Matt? Are you still there?
I think we lost him.
Okay. Well, I'll just jump in here and I'll give you my my reaction to the show.
Okay.
Yeah, so completely awesome, awesome, fantastic movie. Great turn on the horror franchise. A lot of comedy throughout. A lot of really just engaging performances. Just a really, really enjoyable, fun movie. And I think this kind of goes – yeah.
Okay. I'm back on.
Yeah, we got you back. We just kept going without you.
No, I heard. Okay.
Okay.
We're professionals. Keep going.
Just keep going. The show must go on. Yeah. So incredibly engaging performances and just a fun movie that you can enjoy going into it not knowing what to expect. They seeded a little bit in the trailers, and like you said, like Adam had mentioned, they did kind of fuck up on one of them and give away a plot point that should have been kept under wraps just for the sake of the plot of the movie. But I think they could have gotten away with a little bit more. They could have given away the plot a little bit more to entice more people to go see it. And hopefully by people like us doing this, sort of the informative, the pleading for people to go out and see this movie, hopefully more people will go out and see it over the next couple of weeks. The third act of this thing blew me away. I was like on the edge of my seat. I had the biggest grin on my face, and I was just really excited to see what was going to happen next. And it was just completely insane. Like, completely insane. I haven't seen anything like that on the big screen in a really long time. I can't even think of anything to compare it to be honest with you. Yeah.
The thing about the third act is because when I saw it first at South by Southwest, and then I saw it again last night. When I saw it at South by Southwest, they're in the scene where they're betting on what monster they're going to summon. You see the board next to them, and like you're looking at clown zombies, and like, and then like unicorn is on there, and I'm like, oh man, those are all so much fun. Oh well. And then at the end, like, you see all of them. They told – that is one of my favorite kills of the year.
Best scene ever.
Unicorn. Mm-hmm. Like, and not only does the unicorn stab, it stabs him repeatedly with the horn. But you're right. The third act is just absolutely brilliant in that it's madness. And it all comes together both in – in terms of themes and in terms of just comedy and enjoyment and every, it's just this wonderful summation of where they're going with their point, you know? And to me, what makes it a good film, what makes it satire, is not that it just points out like, oh, this is what's wrong. It's like, we all know what the tropes are. What Cabin does is it has a criticism to it, and it's criticizing both storyteller and audience. And I found that to be a really, that to me is what set it over the edge. It wasn't just a parody, because that's the difference between parody and satire.
Sure.
Yeah, it didn't just say like, this is what happens in every horror movie, isn't that dumb?
Right, exactly. This is, to me, it's like Sinners in the hands of an angry screenwriter. This is such this is such a writer's movie. For people who are just, they see it and they're like, why? A lot of people just stopped asking why. Well, why this thing over this thing? And
saying as a writer's movie, anybody that's familiar or a fan of Whedon and Goddard, because he's done some good work too, I think it just gets a little overshadowed by Whedon's presence in this film. But I mean, you could see the thumbprint of these guys all over this film, and I loved every second of it. I mean, it was going back to the days of, you know, sort of the Angel and Buffy series. Were you guys familiar with Angel?
Oh yeah.
This is actually the very first thing of Whedon's I've seen besides Toy Story and Alien Resurrection.
Gotcha.
It's okay. Definitely Whedon. I mean, Dave, you go on, but I think we're about to hit the same page. But you talk about where you're going.
Yeah. So I think it was in the Angel series where there was this sort of very elite law firm called Wolfram and Hart, and they were basically this sort of ancient evil characters that had their fingers in many pies that were kind of controlling everything, sort of the end of days type of thing. And to me, Cabin in the Woods was a feature film extension of that kind of idea, and it was great because it felt like I was watching, you know, bits of that show again, but, you know, with a bigger budget and on the big screen.
Right, absolutely. And it's something that Whedon has brought into his TV series, is that there's a distrust of authority.
Sure.
And not only is that in Angel with Wolfram and Hart, but in Firefly, you have the Blue Sun Corporation and the Alliance. And then in Buffy, you have some seasons, you have the mayor as the villain in one season. You have this sort of military complex organization in season 4 as the villain. So there's definitely that distrust that he has of sort of these institutions.
And I think part of the brilliance of Cabin in the Woods, it opens with Bradley Whitford and Richard Jenkins setting them up as just normal guys working a job on and as it moves along, you're like, oh, this must be, they must be doing the right thing. Like they must, like, obviously they're going to be redeemed. Like this must be, this is just a necessary evil. It has to happen. But it's slowly revealed that, you know, kind of these guys are no good, but due to the charisma of Whitford and Jenkins, you're still pulling for them all the way to the end.
I would love to see a TV, even though it completely undermined the point of the movie, I would absolutely watch a TV series that takes place before the movie, just Whitford and Jenkins at Evil Mission Control. Just like their day-to-day lives, like them, like the times they tried before. And I love that they're constantly thwarted by the Japanese.
Yes, that was brilliant. I love those cuts to the Japanese.
Oh my God, her evil spirit is in the frog. Because even that, it's making fun of other... It's not just our country in horror. It's like this whole Japanese, you know, evil ghost genre. It's like that's tired. Like it's not just contained to what we're doing.
Sure.
Everyone else is just relying on these empty tropes and no one's thinking them through. And seeing it on a second viewing, there are a lot of little things I noticed that I really liked. For instance, when they go down into the basement, and they're all looking at like the little devices, like what's going to summon them. The two people who survive at the end, Dana and Marty. Dana reads a book, and Marty is looking at film strips. I just thought that was a really nice touch. Like the two people who survive are two people who notice writing and film.
See, and that's the great thing about this is that, like I said, my faults with Lockout before was the attention to detail. This movie is the complete opposite of that. The attention to detail throughout the film is immaculate. It's fantastic. And it's refreshing because it lets you know that not only the performers, but also the writers and the director, they've got this vision, this overarching vision that's going to connect every single dot. You know, I think it was Jenkins. Was it Jenkins or Whitford's character? I can't remember who it was. That was talking about the merman.
Whitford.
Yeah, so Whitford's character talking about the merman, and they bring it up. I think it was the rule of three. I think he brought it up a third time, and the third time was definitely the payoff. things like that, things where that you can connect them from the beginning to the end, or you can go back on a second viewing and see it and be like, oh, that's what that was, or man, that would have been cool to see that particular right. detail. I think they did a great job at connecting everything from beginning to end.
Absolutely. And then there was just even the Lovecraftian ancient ones at the end, because that's just a callback to back when these monsters were original. And when for Lovecraft, they're spooky, but at the same time, like the design of the ancient ones and At the Mounds of Madness doesn't, I mean, they're just weird looking creatures. Like they're starfish shaped and they're just meant to be otherworldly, and but the monster and the plot don't necessarily tie together. It's scary in what you're seeing in a monster film, and perhaps someone who's more intimate with Lovecraft will dispute me on why those two tie together. But for me, I don't think Whedon is like blaming Lovecraft for the whole monster empty thing. But what he's saying is this goes back to a guy when he did it; it was original, and you're just not thinking about it. Okay, like so he can do this, and he's been doing, I mean, he's a forebear. He's like a forefather of the horror genre. So sure. In some ways, they're like, we need a new forefather here. We need, because this guy, he's just going to reach out of the ground and destroy everything. Okay, so we have to throw it all the way back to him, because what's been happening since, there's been very little to push the genre forward.
I think that was actually Lovecraft in the ground. That was him coming up. If they would have let the cameras roll a little bit longer, you would have seen.
Oh, yeah. He was a tall dude. People don't know a lot of Lovecraft. Yeah. He was tall and rocky.
Angry. So angry.
So angry. He had to be appeased with sacrifices. And this is just a biography of Lovecraft. You can find this on Wikipedia. It's common knowledge.
Absolutely.
It's common knowledge.
Well, the sad thing is that all of this carefully constructed commentary on the state of horror, it's completely all lost on the majority of the general audience. The people behind me, as I was walking out, the lady was saying, I thought that was going to be like Friday the 13th, but it wasn't.
I do not envy Lionsgate their task in this. They had an to me, sometimes you just blame the marketing. Like I blame the marketing of Mirror Mirror. I blame the marketing of even Three Stooges for making those films look much worse than they actually were. For Cabin in the Woods, I have no idea how you market this movie and keep it secret.
Yeah.
And I agree. You don't need to show Marty coming back. Like, that is unnecessary. But at the same time, it's like when you're giving out a synopsis and you don't even mention in the synopsis the whole evil mission control people, like, what do you do with that kind of way to sell the film? And it's furthermore, it's like nothing else out there. So you have to sell, you're trying to sell a Cabin in the Woods movie that is the anti-Cabin in the Woods movie.
And it's called Cabin in the Woods.
Exactly.
If you sell the straight horror movie, the horror crowd and like the date night Friday nights are going to come and they're going to be disappointed because it's not that movie. Whedon and Goddard try hard and they do add like scares. They try to appease that part of the audience for a little bit. There are scares, you know.
I don't think the movie's scary. That's the other thing. I don't think the film's scary.
There's jump scares. There's a good amount of jump scares. There's tension. There's enough in there, I think, to satisfy a horror fan, I think.
But if you market it to the cinephile crowd, the people that are looking for something new and fresh and original, then the spin is gone. The twist is gone.
Right. So there's sometimes where I'll say you marketed this wrong. I have no idea how you market this film. The best you can do to me, honestly, is word of mouth.
Yeah. Exactly.
Maybe if they had just, I don't know, loaded up on pre-screenings and just really. Because really, I mean, when it's showing at South by Southwest, that's about a month. You have about a month to build buzz off of that. And I think perhaps more promo screenings could have helped. And I think we'll maybe see that in terms of seeing how Cabin in the Woods does over the following weekends. Because really, next weekend is wide open. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe I really don't know how either of the three wide releases are really going to dominate. I think Hunger Games will win the box office for a fifth straight week.
Going up against Nicholas Sparks and Zac Efron.
I mean, how well did Charlie St. Cloud do? I know that's not Nicholas Sparks, but how well did that movie do?
I think you're sorely underestimating the female crowd, the Nicholas Sparks crowd.
I think that female crowd goes see Hunger Games again.
Do you?
I think that movie comes in second place. I can see that movie coming in second, but what I'm interested to see is how much of a drop does Cabin in the Woods have? Because looking at its box office over the weekend, it did have a rare jump from Friday to Saturday nights. Mm. or so there was some. I was reading the box, and I think that was the jump. It made something unusual that was indicative of word of mouth. I hope that more people see it in theaters, and that is my hope. But I think for me, good movies like this always find their audience, so it'll get passed around on DVD and all that stuff. I think the advantage is you want to see this now because you can't keep that lid on the spoilers forever.
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't see Fight Club when it was in theater. Like, I didn't get a chance to see it, and as the weeks piled on, some stupid girl at my high school was like, "Oh yeah, Tyler Durden," you know, like she spoiled it for me, and I'm like, "Thanks." And also coming at it from outside the film, like, that makes no fucking sense. Like, I just see the movies, like, they're the same person. I'm like, "What? What is happening?" So anyway, that's.
I think it'll find its audience. I mean, like Scott Pilgrim, the people that love Scott Pilgrim, it got passed around on DB.
Exactly. And see, now that was a film I think where the marketing was problematic. And, but that's for the marketing gurus to decide. Actually, no, I'll decide it. The marketing of that film was bad because it was trying to reach a female audience that wasn't interested in it. Lost a gamer audience that would have probably piled in more to see it if they had known what it was. And if they had known more that it was a comedy. Anyway, so after criticizing the marketing of Scott Pilgrim, what a weird way to end the show. Thank you for the people who have seen Cabin in the Woods because are listening right now because you saw Cabin in the Woods and you're listening, or you're just not spoiler phobic and hopefully we have convinced you to see Cabin in the Woods. Either way, thank you for listening all the way to the end. This is a longer than normal show, but for Cabin in the Woods, we feel it's worth it. Come back next week where we won't be talking about The Lucky One, Chimpanzee, or Think Like a Man. What we will be talking about is The Raid. Finally going to be talking The Raid. I wish Dave could be with us on that one, but Adam and I were going to have some fun with that.
I'll record my own separate notes, and I'll send them to you separately.
We're going to edit them in.
There you go.
I'm just kidding. Clearly, I don't know how to edit anything. That mess up with my headset dropping out, that's going to be in the show because I don't know how to drop it and Dead weave space. It all together. It's going to be fantastic. All right. Thank everyone for listening, and we will be back on Sunday. You can find this podcast at CollisionCast. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Goldberg. Adam, where can we find you?
At Adam Chitwood.
And Dave, where can we find you?
At Dr. Claw MD.
I love signing off with Dave saying his Twitter name. All right. Thanks for listening. We'll be back on Sunday.
See you guys.
Thanks.